First, thank everybody for coming here tonight. Today, I was being just a usual tourist, actually. That's what I did. I was just a tourist until now. Now, I don't feel I'm a tourist anymore. And we went out with my friend Dun. And Dun, I hope I'm pronouncing their name correctly. Three of my friends took me out to really visit this very popular site for tourists. These giant temples and the statues of Buddhas and Padas. When I listen, all I heard is English, maybe French and Mandarin. I hardly heard anybody speak in Thai. And then we went to see some play, the Ramayana play, and then we ate lunch. And now I'm here. But what I felt is that there's so much relevance to the Buddha here in this culture. That's why your people, your ancestors built this just magnificent temples. I found that the architecture of the temples are some of the most amazing, not just the Buddhist architecture, but a human creation. And then you can see that people put so much heart, so much love, and so much their skill to create the images of Shakyamuni Buddha. There was one image of Buddha that I visited as the last site for me today. The image of Buddha, the golden image of Buddha, was so amazing. I look at the throne of the Buddha, just so intricate that they spent many, many days and months to create that statue of Buddha. But the creation is so magnificent that stopped my mind, actually, literally. It stopped my mind. I just couldn't have any thought. There was a period of no mind because the integrity, just the wonder of that statue, it's so overwhelming that literally made my mind to pause. And there was a kind of silence which I enjoyed very much. And just like that, this culture, Thai culture, has a deep reverence to the Shakyamuni Buddha. You can feel that reverence pretty much everywhere, not only in temples, but even in most ordinary atmospheres, like even restaurants or shopping malls. The reverence to the Buddha is everywhere. And then we have, of course, all these sutras which are taught by Buddha himself. I think it's important to revere the Buddha, but also we have to remember why do we revere Buddha, actually. I think we revere Buddha not because he was a prophet or he was some kind of messiah, but a Buddha was a wise man, awakening man, who actually taught a very profound truth, such as a love, compassion, bodhicitta, awakened heart, not man or not no self, and the shunyata, the emptiness. In Tibetan temples, we have lots of actually statues of Buddhas. one of most revered statue in Tibet is actually a statue of Buddha, which is enshrined in a temple called the Suklakang in the city of Lhasa, which was an old Tibetan capital city. There is a statue of Buddha, which is a very decorated. It was given by Chinese Emperor Tang Taizong to Tibetan King Songtsen Gambo in the 7th century. That statue of Buddha is considered the most precious, and it's utterly revered that every Tibetan person want to make a journey to visit that statue once in their lifetime. So statues of Buddha are really revered, but we have this also saying that when you put statues of Buddha and the sutras, especially the Paramjana Paramita sutras, they would advise never put statues of Buddha on the sutras. You can put sutras on the top of the statue of Buddha, but never put the statue of Buddha on the sutra. In some sense, they actually tell us that the sutras are more sacred than statues of Buddha. And this is very interesting in some sense. I think there's a lot of messages in that whole idea. One is that we have to realize that Buddha is not actually a savior. He's not God. He was an awakened teacher. But we have to practice the Dharma that he taught to awaken our mind. You can, of course, worship Buddha, but Buddha is not like some kind of God or Messiah that can set our soul free. By the way, in Buddhism, there are no soul. So, so it reminds us that the only way that we can find true freedom, the inner freedom, is by practicing the teachings that Buddha taught. And the teachings on the love and compassion, and teachings on the ultimate truth, such as the emptiness. This is why they actually always tell you to make sure that you should put the sutras above the statue of Buddha. So when you visit Tibetan temples, there will be one section in the temple where they enshrine the 12 volumes of Paramjana Paramita Sutras. These sutras illuminate the great emptiness, which is the ultimate truth in the Buddhism, or especially in Mahayana Buddhism. But what is actually emptiness? And that's a very big topic too. So emptiness is in some sense, very simple. On the other hand, it can be a little bit so much tricky, but it can be very subtle, can be sometimes very abstract too. So basically, Buddha said that we can have happiness. We can have pretty much a good time in this human incarnation. But if you want to be truly free, if you want to be truly liberated inside, and then Buddha said, you must realize and you must experience emptiness. It's not like that you have to realize the emptiness in order to be happy. That's not what Buddha was actually saying. I think we can be pretty happy. Sometimes we can be happy without being even spiritual too. There are a lot of people who are very happy without doing any kind of spiritual practices, you see. Lots of people tend to be happy just by being human being and living their life. Many people are kind of happy until some challenge happens, until some difficulty strike their life, like illness or death or dying or lose their fortune, then most people tend to be very challenged. But Usually, I think lots of people tend to be happy without being really spiritual too. I know actually people in my life who don't meditate, but they tend to be kind of happy. Whereas I know Buddhist people who meditate, but some of them are very unhappy. So that's kind of strange comparison. I have a cousin who's a Tibetan person, and he's very happy. He's a plumber. He loves his job as a plumber. He immigrated from Tibet to the United States, and he became a pretty good plumber. For him, his job as a plumber is a religion. So sometimes we get together with other plumbers, and they can talk for hours about plumbing business. They can talk about all these instrument devices that you use as a plumbers. And he's very happy. And whenever he is called to do some work for somebody's whatever septic system, like house septic system can broke, he's very happy, you see, but he doesn't meditate at all. He's very happy. So sometimes I think maybe I should be like him, not meditate, not to teach Dharma. Maybe become plumber, then I will be very happy. And he's a kind of good person too. He has some kind of ethics. He is a very reliable person, but he doesn't meditate. He's a Tibetan. He might identify himself as a Buddhist, but he doesn't meditate. He doesn't read any Buddhist scriptures. He just get up early morning, go to work, and then come back. That's pretty much it. But he seemed to be kind of happy. And so it's not like that we all have to be enlightened. We all have to realize the emptiness in order to be happy. We are not actually saying that. You know, there are so many people in this world who would never actually think of emptiness. Emptiness would not be a thing that they would even pay attention to. But Buddha said again and again that if you really want to be truly free, then you have to realize emptiness. In some sense, it's a very important topic. Buddha said in many sutras, Mahayana sutras, you have to have some kind of good karma, even to hear the word emptiness. This is a little bit of kind of dramatic statement. Try to think that you have lots of good karma, or maybe from past lives, to have the opportunity to come across teachings on the emptiness. Kind of makes sense in some sense. It's not like everybody's interested in emptiness. There's maybe more than a handful of people, but there are very few people who are truly interested in emptiness. When you think of the whole world population, there are around 7 billion people. That's quite a lot. I don't think there's even 1 billion people who are actively trying to understand the emptiness, you see. So Buddha said in Mahayana Sutras, you have to have some good karma, whatever that means, to even come across teachings on the emptiness, which means that you have good karma somehow. And otherwise, you'll not be here tonight to hear teachings on emptiness. So, but what is really emptiness? But in order to talk about emptiness, which is the ultimate truth, we kind of have to talk about why we are not awakened to the emptiness. I think we have to think about reality in general. As a human being, we have this mind, this human consciousness, which is an amazing, amazing faculty. I think the human mind is one of the most powerful, most amazing faculty that exists in the realm of a universe. It can think, it can feel, it can analyze, it can create, it can conceptualize, it can reflect. So this mind, human mind, is incredible. But then, because the human mind has this extraordinary capacity to conceptualize, the human mind actually can think and can also experience being separate from everything else. And also human mind has the capability to create lots of narratives, in other words, storylines. That's what human mind does, it creates storylines. So some sense, our human life, our version of reality is just lots of storylines, lots of narratives. That's pretty much it. And from that point of view, we are kind of living a reality that is like a dream, that is pretty much made out of lots of storylines. Even this storyline too, this is a narrative that our mind created, even though it's a good narrative like that. We are in Bangkok right now, and we try to organize this event, and I'm here, this person called Anam Thapten showed up, and he's talking about emptiness. But these are all kind of storylines that our mind is making up. You see? Just like that, it's anything we do, the whole human life, the whole human journey is usually built upon a lot of narratives and storylines because our mind is capable of creating stories, mental construct all the time. So in some sense, I found that the animals are kind of enlightened. The animals are always kind of experiencing emptiness, except I think the only difference between human beings and animals, some animals don't know that they're experiencing emptiness, even though they're experiencing emptiness, but they don't know they're experiencing emptiness. But if they know that they're experiencing emptiness, they all would be enlightened. Like I have a bunch of animals at my home. I have one cat and I have one dog. And I look at them, to me in some sense they're kind of very enlightened because I don't think they have lots of concepts. They don't think so much, you know. They love me very much, especially both my dog, my pet. They both love me very much because I pet them all the time. I pet my cat. Whenever I come back from trip to home, my cat always approach me because I give him lots of petting. But they don't have any concept. They don't think, oh, Anam Thapten is a Tibetan Lama. They have no idea. Oh, he just come back from teaching tour. They have no idea who I am. They don't have any slightest idea about who I am. They just feel there, maybe feel some kind of, I don't know, closeness with me, or they know that I give them pet, I give them food. I'm sure they have some emotions and really very strong feelings in relationship to me, but they really don't have any kind of conceptual idea about me or about them or about their relationship with me or all. I don't think my cat think, oh, I'm cat, you see. I'm cat, you know. He's Anam Thapten. I belong to him or he belong to me. I live in Bay Area, San Francisco. My cat never think that way. Whereas I think, you know, I think I'm Anam Thapten, and I think I live in a San Francisco Bay Area, it's a particular location, and I have a whole story happening in my mind, who I am, my past, where I grew up, what I did, my plans in the future, my role in this world. So I have lots of ideas, concepts about who I am, and my journey as a human being, and my relationship with the world, and that is true for all of you, right? When you really pause and when you look into your mind, you have a whole book. You have a huge book of your own life. You have a lot of stories, narratives about who you are, where you grew up, what you did, your role in society, your own self-image, and your also plans, your goals for the future, your religion, your nationality, your achievement, as well as your failures. And then, not only that, we have also a whole storyline about the world, the reality, and we have sometimes very big stories, like stories, like religious stories about God, divinity. It's huge stories. And then we have mundane stories. We have like politics, social issues. These are kind of more mundane stories that our mind constructed. And then, even simplest thing, if I pick up this ball, this one, we call this as a cup, right? We all agree this is a cup, actually. But is this really a cup? This is a cup because we all decide to call this as a cup. One time, a Zen Buddhist teacher and a very famous Tibetan Rinpoche were invited by Stanford University and to have a dialogue. Many people participated in this dialogue because they both are very famous Buddhist teachers. This Zen teachers and Tibetan Lama Rinpoche both sat on a stage. And then there was a table between them. On the table, there was an orange. The Zen master picked up the orange and asked the Tibetan Lama, "What is this?" And then the Tibetan Lama whispered to the ear of his translator. The Lama said that maybe this Zen master come from a country where there's no orange. That's orange. So that was a humorous, very humorous answer, but I think the Zen master was inviting everybody to meditate on the emptiness. What he's trying to say is even orange, it's not really orange. We call it orange, but it's not really orange in some sense, you see. We just labeled it as an orange. So pretty much everything that we are perceiving in this life are just lots of labels, mental designation, even like when you think of borders between countries, it's a totally mental designation. I live in the United States right now. I think I spent the last 30 years there. I feel that it's almost my second home. Even though I grew up in Tibet, I actually don't miss so much Tibet anymore. I know I grew up there, but as the year goes by, I keep kind of forgetting Tibet. And I don't have lots of even desire to go back there. Periodically, I talk to some of my Dharma friends back in Tibet. That's pretty much it. So I feel that the United States is my home, my second home. Maybe now Thailand is going to be my second home too. We're talking about that I felt that I've been here for a long time, even though I was here only 10 days, but I felt that I have been here for a long time. This is my home. You know, sometimes I think I speak Thai fluently, even though I just speak one word. It's like my mind is kind of hallucinating itself. Oh, I can speak Thai really fluently. The truth, I don't even speak one word. But that's how I feel. I feel I have been here for a long time. I felt really relaxed, felt at home. I love Thai food. I mean, who doesn't love Thai food, right? Everybody loves Thai food in this world. But I just feel very much at home here in this beautiful country, the land of smile. Thousand reasons why I feel so much at home. I think there's a very much kindness everywhere here, and gentleness, kindness, generosity, reverence. Your culture is, in my opinion, very peaceful. I didn't feel any kind of aggression. I didn't feel too much ego in your culture. I feel lots of gentleness. So maybe that's why I feel I've been here for a very long time somehow. I can make your country as my second home easily. What I'm trying to say is that When I live in the United States, I end up talking about politics. It's almost you have to talk politics. Even when I give Dharma teachings, it's hard not to talk about politics right now. I don't know whether this is true in Thailand or not. And even some of my Sangha members kind of told me that I should talk about politics, and I should talk about politics from Buddhist perspective, in which I understand where they're coming from, because I think as a Buddhist, we have to engage with the politics, social issues. Otherwise, our Buddhist practice can be some kind of like a spiritual escapism, and where we can just delve into some kind of spiritual, whatever, false nirvana, pseudo nirvana, and where we can be totally disconnected with the world. And also, Buddhism is not more than just being blissed out. Buddhism is also about engaging with the world and to help people and to develop compassion, courage, and also to help other people, to help the society, and to change the society, and to be active in order to change the society. So that's what really true Buddhism is. So for example, yesterday we had a really nice gathering at the Meditation Retreat Center. A group of you took Bodhisattva's vow. Some of you were there, remember yesterday? Group of you took Bodhisattva's vow. Bodhisattva is the sacred warrior who is a whole desire is not just to seek peace or enlightenment or nirvana or nibbana, doesn't really matter. In Sanskrit, nirvana, in Pali, nibbana, for yourself. Instead, and to open your heart and to engage with the world and also face all the challenges, all the difficulties that life presents you, and also to basically help the others and to change society, change yourself, but also change society and change the world to the best of your ability. That is the ethos of Bodhisattva. So it was really nice for me to see that many of you, almost like close to 30 people, took the Bodhisattva as well. So the principle of Bodhisattva is to be in the world and not to just seek enlightenment for yourself, but to engage the world and trying to bring about positive change to the world. That's the Bodhisattva as well. Therefore, sometimes I think we some, not all of them, but some Buddhists, they're kind of lost in their own spirituality. They feel quite a peace and bliss, and they feel very holy. And then they sometimes really don't engage with the social political issues. And therefore, I feel it's very necessary to engage with the social political issues. So we talk about politics, either directly or indirectly, as a very much a Buddhist teaching and Buddhist practice too. So right now in the United States, you may have heard that there's an issue right now, the issue with the border. And some people believe that you have to close the border. There's a whole political force led by many conservative party, and they believe that you have to close the border, and many of them actually hold ideology that seems to be a xenophobia for me. And they kind of tend to believe that all these refugees, immigrants are not really, they're human but kind of subhuman. And then they believe that the border is real, and borders have to be protected. And then the other, of course, forces and the whole another political doctrine, and that is based on, to me, more like compassion and wisdom. And many of these people believe that we should welcome everybody who wants to come to the country. So when you think border, actually border is also not real. Border is illusion, you see, there are no border in ultimate sense. So you can apply emptiness to your personal life, to social politics, you can apply emptiness to anything. I think if we begin to apply the idea of emptiness, lots of problems go away, actually. Our own problems in life will go away, and lots of political, social issues will be resolved. Only if we apply the Buddhist principle of emptiness. So like think of border. Border is actually man-made. Border is not real. But somehow, in our mind, even collectively, tend to believe that the border between nations is actually real, it's intrinsic, as if it has been from the very beginning, from the time immemorial. Therefore, when the astronauts go into outer space, and some of them had actually literally spontaneous mystical experiences without the need to recite mantra or meditation. It's like they experience emptiness, literally. So when they go away from the Earth, it's kind of hard to see, hard to experience sometimes transcendence when you are kind of locked up in the your small community and in this kind of earthly reality where there's so much division. But when the astronauts fly into outer space, so they experience this spontaneous transcendent religious experience that is very similar to the idea of emptiness, because they look back, just this earth is actually utterly beautiful, this earth that we call home. It's utterly beautiful. But they also see that there's no border. There's no border between nationalities. They don't see any division. They don't see any divisions between religions. They don't see any divisions between humanity, this race and that race, you see. So they experience this kind of almost the transcendence, just realize that there's no really duality. They see all the duality that we created are kind of mental construct. And sometimes maybe they wish that humanity will come together and put all the differences aside and love each other and work for the common goal. And lots of the wars in this world actually came from believing that we're separate from each other. That's what tribalism is the root of many of the wars in the world. And tribalism is based on this belief that we are separate, we are different intrinsically, even though we are not actually. So sometimes without meditating, I think the universe, if we are open, if our mind is open, shown the ultimate reality, the emptiness. It's shown all the time, the emptiness. If only you open your mind. And sometimes they say silence is the entry into the emptiness. And that's why in Buddhism we practice lots of silence. Silence is the mantra in some sense. Silence is the sutra. It's a sutra without words. Silence is a mantra, mantra without syllables. When we hold a meditation retreat in my sangha, we usually recite some poems. to set the tone for the entire meditation retreat, one of the poem I usually read is from Shakarpa, another great Dzogchen master like Jigme Langpa. In this poem, Shakarpa said that if you sit like an Indian sage, refers to the Buddha, and then if you stop talking, and then he said, enlightenment, awakening will come to you. Basically, he said that if you're able to observe silence, and then so know that all your concepts, all your stories, all your narratives about yourself, the past, future, the world, politics, social issues, your personal conflict, your daily affairs, they all dissolve actually. So what remains is the emptiness, a true silence, a reality, dimensional reality that is free from all conflict, free from all storylines. Buddhism come up with many methods that help us to experience emptiness. In Zen, they use a koan. In Tibetan Buddhism, they also use we use lots of inquiry. There's called a Madhyamaka meditation. It's a whole set of inquiry where you ask everything. You ask what is self, and then eventually you experience that your idea of reality is just a mental construct, and then you see the true nature reality beyond all your mental construct, your concept, your ideas, your opinions. And sometimes they even use very radical methods to allow you to experience emptiness in an immediate fashion. But I think silence is sometimes the most powerful immediate doorway to the emptiness, because when you sit in silence, eventually your mind becomes quiet. So quiet that all the stories, all the conflict that you have in your life dissolve. And you feel that you are somehow dropping into this peaceful dimension of reality. Even sense of self sometimes can go there too. So when I pick up this cup, and I said, this is not really a cup, or this is really hard to believe that it's not a cup. So imagine that we are sitting in a Buddhist temple, and imagine that we're going to meditate on the emptiness for 3 months. Just try to imagine that. Imagine that we all are sitting in a monastery in Tibet or somewhere, and somehow we signed a 3 months long meditation retreat on the emptiness, or maybe longer than that, maybe how about 1 year? And then imagine that we just blocked our calendar and changed our schedules. We decided to be in 1 year long meditation retreat and the emptiness. So then, let's say, maybe imagine that I'm the instructor, meditation instructor. So maybe I will give you a homework, all of you. I will say, what is this? Maybe I give you a cup, or I give you a flower. Well, it's hard to find flowers in Tibet. Maybe I give you a teapot, and then maybe I ask you to meditate and to ask, what is this? Eventually you come to realization that this is not actually a cup. This is not a flower. So our mind just called this is a cup. Our mind called this is a flower. And our mind called this is a earphone. But it's not an earful. So emptiness means empty of swabhava, intrinsic reality. So this is not an intrinsic earphone. So sometimes I invite people to actually gaze into each other's eyes. I used to do that meditation quite a lot. Like I invite people and divide into groups, and two people gaze into each other's eyes. A very powerful meditation for emptiness. Because usually the moment you see somebody, you have lots of ideas already. You know, you have lots of ideas of the other person. Especially if you feel you know that person, you have lots of ideas about that person. And when I grew up in a monastery, there's one Lama, his name is Thukul Tratun. He's a very good Lama. And my monastery is kind of famous, but not too famous, called Mahando Drashi Ganja. It was seat of very famous Dzogchen master, Denjom Lama. But monastery is not that famous in Tibet. It's relatively famous, but there are other monasteries which are way more famous than my monastery. Monastery famous in one valley. So he told me that he really didn't go beyond the parameter of that region in which my monastery is famous. So he is a respected Lama, so everybody respects him. And they regard him as a holy man, a tulku, so he's very revered. So everybody knows who he is. They all revered him. When they see him, they take off with their hat and they invite him to perform pujas. But he said one time he had to go away from my home region to another part of Tibet where nobody knew. And then nobody treated him as like holy man because nobody knew. So he said that was a very powerful experience. He said in my region, he was regarded as holy man, but once he leave that territory, he just becomes an ordinary person. Nobody perceives him as a tulku or holy person. They perceive him as just very ordinary. So this is very interesting, isn't it? So for somebody, he's a holy man, but for some people, he's ordinary. He had some kind of very powerful insight from that whole experience. So imagine that if we bring two people together, if we divide into groups, and if two of you face towards each other, so especially if you know that person, you would have lots of ideas. Oh, I know this person. I know this person's history, you see. I like this person very much. This person's I know his or her address, I know his achievement, and so forth. Or maybe sometimes imagine that you have some kind of judgment towards somebody, then you think, oh, I know this person, I'm not so crazy about this person, I wish you, Anam Thubten, put me with that person instead of this person in the meditation exercise. Does this make sense? I really don't want to look into the eye of this person, because we used to invite two people to gaze into each other's eyes, which was very powerful meditation. You know, some people we don't like. We have lots of concept of somebody. And usually when we have a judgment towards other people, it's not actually, it's not so much something wrong with these people. It's just like some people, I don't know, they have some kind of talent to evolve your own judgment. Does it make sense? Your own aversion, your own negative bias. So your perception of the other people, not even who they are, it's just somehow they have talent, or maybe they signed karmically, said their job is to evoke all your inner demons, like your judgment, your prejudice, etc. You see? And therefore, when we usually do meditation, heart meditation, we invite different groups. Many of you have been to my heart meditation. We invite a few group people in our mind. First, we visualize all our family members in front of us, our children, our parents. And usually we love them, yeah, most of the time. And then we invite our friends in our mind. We put them there in front of us on our right side in our mind. And then usually ask people to visualize somebody or group of people who often, when you think of them, who often evoke your inner demons like prejudice, like judgment, aversion. And then indirectly remind that we have to know that our aversion, our prejudice towards them have nothing to do with them, but they're just our own projections. And so, but people, when they sometimes gaze into each other's eyes, magic happens actually. What happens, their stories begin to dissolve. That's so amazing, isn't it? That's another meditation on emptiness. I don't do that anymore because it's kind of a little bit intense, yeah, for some people, too much to gaze into other people's eyes. Especially these days, it's a little bit too much, yeah. So I don't invite people to do those gazing meditations. But the old days we did, and then when you look into somebody's eyes, first you have a concept of that person, and then each concept began to dissolve one after another. And then you have no more any ideas of that person in front of you. All you see is just pure, pure presence, pure awareness. All your judgment, your projections, your opinions of that person just fall apart as if they were not there in the first place. So then you see that person as just pure presence, pure awareness, pure spirit, that's all you see. And then you begin to see the true nature of that person, the emptiness within that person. And then maybe you're able to see the Buddha in that person, the Adi Buddha, Buddha nature in that person. Many Tibetan lamas said that they see Buddha in everybody. In everybody, literally. Dzogchen Rinpoche, very famous Dzogchen master, he said, when he walk outside, he see the Buddha in everybody, regardless of whether they are monk or nun, or ordinary, to the extent that he feels so moved that he feels that he have to pay homage. He feels that he have to bow to everybody whom he ran into street. But he said that would be a little bit unconventional. It's not even practical. Can you imagine that you are going around in a Bangkok and bowing to everybody on the street? You know, they think you're a little bit strange. And they say, why are you bound to everybody? You can say, oh, I see Buddha in everybody. See, that would be quite amazing. Mm-hmm. Because like Dzogchen Rinpoche, these Dzogchen masters don't actually see people through projections, but see the emptiness in each everyone. They see the true nature of everyone through clear, undiluted state of consciousness. a friend of mine told that he went to India in 1970s, and he had the opportunity to sit in the presence of a very, very awakened spiritual teacher in India. He is an American. And then he told me that spiritual teacher in India often had audience, and he had sometimes Indian people come and do his sermon, which has a very different vibe. And then he told me that sometimes he will give a sermon teaching to Westerners, like people from Europe, people from North America. He said he sat in the presence of that teacher many times. And then he told me that when he teach the Western audience, lots of people raised their hands towards the end of the teaching. Lots of them had questions. Maybe Indians didn't have lots of questions. So maybe culture, they don't ask lots of questions. But he told me lots of Westerners, Europeans, North Americans raised their hands. And he told me that they all have problems. And they ask him, "Oh, Master, can you give me advice? Because I have a problem in my relationship." Or someone said, "Can you give me advice because my children are not doing very well in their school?" Or, "Can you give me advice on money, etc.?" Or, "Can you give me advice on how to resolve conflict with such and such person?" And then the Sunguru always said the same thing. He gave one answer. He said, "Don't worry, nothing ever has happened." That was the answer. He said, "Don't worry, nothing has ever happened." This is a very strange response, isn't it? So what Guru was saying is that everything that you are talking about, all your conflict, never really happened in reality. It just happened in your mind. I think that's what he was trying to say. And so I think lots of the conflict that we experience in our life are not really out there. It's just happening in our mind. Our mind is creating all kind of conflict problems when there's not so much conflict in the realm of reality. And therefore, very famous Zen master, Shinryu Suzuki Roshi, and the day when he taught, and some of the students had they ask him, "Do you watch movies?" They ask him. He said, "No, I don't watch movies because I don't need to watch movies." They said, "Why?" He said, "I do lots of interviews." So usually lots of Buddhist teachers, they call interviews, right? Maybe you call it also interviews in the East too. But lots of usually spiritual students, practitioners have audience with their teacher, and then they have lots of questions to the teacher, and that's called interviews. And he said, "I don't have to watch movies. I do lots of interviews with my students." He said, "That's like movie. It's even maybe more interesting than movie too, right?" For him, movie, because he listened to everybody's story problems. For him, it's like all movie. It's not real. It's all happening in their head. That's what he sees. So in the realm of emptiness, there's not really conflict, you see. Conflict, struggle, suffering only take place in the realm of this mind, this dualistic mind. Let's sit in silence for a few seconds. Thank you for the silence. Did you experience emptiness already? Nice, isn't it, to be in silence? Even teaching on emptiness is just another concept, you see? It's good to sometimes pause and not say even one word, you see? Maybe all talks to get to this point where we can just sit in silence for a while. Because if you jump into silence from the beginning, the silence won't be that special. So did you feel that contrasting between me talking quite a lot about emptiness, talking about silence, and then stop talking, you see? That contrasting is quite magical, isn't it? Then did you feel the true silence when I stop finally talking?